It's Friday, which means it's time for another exciting episode of Ask Us Anything. We've been away for a while. We took a bit of a Raya break. I had a baby. That kind of gets in the way of work. But we're back, and we're ready to take your questions. At Sue Ann asks, will you be interviewing the cast of Challengers? Oh, how we wish we were, but unfortunately, we are not.
Yeah, pretty straightforward, that one.
Yeah, it's very rare that we get access to indie movies. I know it's a Warner production, but it's kind of like a more indie production. And so given the limited release in Malaysian theaters, a lot of the time the press junkets don't involve teeny tiny markets such as ours.
I mean, the fact that we're even getting it is
a surprise.
Pretty impressive as it is already. Let's not be too concerned with whether or not we'll get interviews for that one.
Yeah, we got it. Go watch it in cinemas. From what I understand, there are very, very few cuts. I believe there's only one cut, but also because a lot of the sexiness is implied and not explicit. So there wasn't very much to cut in the first place.
At JJRL Gunn asks, Monkey Man's shaky camera work, negative or positive? He personally liked it. I liked it too. I think the thing about shaky camera work is that it is like everything else within filmmaking, it is a tool. What message are you trying to deliver with your camera being shaky or your camera being on a tripod shooting wide? It's intention, right? If you have intention for your camera to be shaky, then great, go for it. If you think it looks cool, then you might have a problem.
I don't necessarily have a blanket rule on things that I hate when it comes to tools that are employed. At the moment, I have a particular dislike to in medias res in storytelling, whenever they start a story in between and then kind of flashback. But even for that, when I was watching HBO's The Sympathizer, I'm like, oh, look, Park Chan-wook knows how to use it properly. And there it's done well. I think the same applies for Monkey Man. Dave Patel and the cinematographer had a vision on how they wanted to do it. It isn't the same as every action director following Paul Greengrass after the Bourne movies, because he did it in a certain way and then everyone else kind of fucked it up.
This isn't the shaky camera work thing, but I do have a thing where I feel almost blanket ban on, which is the vignette thing. A lot of these movies are coming out with this really weird fucking vignetting. The best example of a most recent film that I can think of is Rebel Moon. Rebel Moon has got these real heavy vignettes around the corner. And if you don't know what a vignette is, it's essentially the sides and the corners of the frame is blurred. Only like a big sphere or a circle in the middle of the screen is actually in focus. Everything else is moody blur. And I feel like if your character is not drunk or has been knocked in the head or is in any way maybe mentally incapacitated, I think that vignetting thing is bullshit and please fucking stop it.
I totally agree. It's not just movies. It happens in a lot of TV shows as well.
TV's
and if you
it now,
haven't
yeah.
noticed it, now that we've pointed it out, I think you are going to notice it and get very annoyed.
Yeah, yeah.
At Vignesh asks, any news on if and when Civil War is releasing here? We haven't heard anything. We don't know. We've heard that it is coming out in Singapore if it's not out already. But if it's not out next month in May, then the chances are maybe not. But we will let you know as soon as we do.
So we've got three people who've reached out to ask us about Baby Reindeer. You've started it. I haven't.
I finished it.
You finished it. I haven't started it. It's scheduled for sometime next week for a podcast. So I guess just stay tuned to that.
Yeah, we'll get to it. I finished it and I finished it very quickly because it's been one of the better shows on Netflix in a very long time. It's been one of those things that I could not stop watching and I think it's excellent. But for a more detailed review, stay tuned.
Yeah.
At Brandon Xavier asks, lots coming out this week, both Fall Guy and Challengers. Which are you more excited for? That is a very tough question to answer. Bahe has seen Fall Guy. I haven't. I'm going to watch it either this weekend or next week. Same with Challengers. But I'm genuinely excited for both movies. They're both very, very different films. Fall Guy, I was under no illusion that we would not get because it's a major blockbuster. So it's bound to come. It's got big names. Challengers, I am super shocked and surprised that we are getting. So I'm genuinely excited for both.
Having seen Fall Guy, I am also looking forward to Challengers. I mean, we will do our review once Uma sees it, but with Fall Guy, it was never in doubt that that would come. But with Challengers, it is a surprise, and I'm hoping that it's a sign of things to come for Malaysian cinemas. At Dominic Bay asks, thoughts on Tales of the Empire?
So, if you don't know, Tales of the Empire is a brand new animated series that's coming out on Disney Plus. We should have some early access to those episodes, so we will be watching them and reviewing them. However, all we've seen right now is the trailer, but for those who don't know, Tales of the Empire, Tales of the Jedi, they're all based on these anthology stories that were once told either in comic book form or novelizations or both. And growing up, I used to read a lot of those and I enjoyed it because back in the day, that was the kind of insight that we got into the Star Wars universe that wasn't just about the Skywalkers. It was really cool stories about the droids and the bounty hunters and the side characters in Star Wars. And they were all these lovely short stories and the comics were really fantastic. And so I'm a big fan of this sort of stuff because it kind of grows the Star Wars universe out and tells stories that I don't usually get from the Star Wars universe.
I'm a little sort of apprehensive because I agree with everything you just said, except based on the trailer, I don't know how much of that I'll get. I would have loved a straight up What If style anthology series of the Empire and of the Jedi set at numerous and or various times throughout the history, unlike, say, something like Star Wars Visions, which to me is fine. It's cute. I like it. I love more episodes than I don't. However, I kind of want to see more canon-based stories. Canon-based stories within the Star Wars universe. And again, just any time throughout the history of the Jedi.
At Certain Tidal Wave asks, what do you guys think about the aspect ratio in cinemas these days? Are they doing a bad job to not align it perfectly or close the curtains to fit the ratios like they did before? I remember the days when the black bars weren't there and we got to see the full picture. Okay, so Certain Tidal Wave. I think things were a lot simpler in the past. There were certain aspect ratios that filmmakers kind of stuck to. And these days, filmmakers like to play around a lot more. And so you get a variety of aspect ratios. Sometimes they go arty and decide to change aspect ratios within a single movie. Things shot on IMAX cameras look different on different screens. And so it's not actually the cinema's fault. And they play around a lot based on what prints they actually get. So the answer to that question is a lot more complex. However, I have to say, I quite like seeing the different bars either on the top and bottom or the left and right because it allows me to know what the filmmaker was thinking and doing with his decision or her decision in deciding what aspect ratios to use. Like the cinema, sure, even if something is shot square, the cinemas can close the curtains up to match the square, but I think you lose something in your viewing experience when they do that.
Anytime we do like a marathon or a special event at the cinema, I tend to make it, it's the nerd in me, but I tend to make it a point to go up to the cinema screen because I don't normally get to do that. And a lot of times they don't have the curtains anymore. I will, however, agree, I guess, with Certain Tidal Wave in that I really fucking hate the aspect ratio changes. Okay, this isn't Certain Tidal Wave's question, like his question is specifically the physical setup of the cinema, but I wanna agree with you, Uma, but I think, can you all just fucking keep it together? Because look, I get the IMAX thing, right? The IMAX is a squarish image and that's fine, cool, all right, but come the fuck on. Can we just settle on a standard Hollywood style ratio where it's not 2.31 to 1 and 1.9 to 2. Just fuck off. Just pick one and be done with it. It changes very little. I feel, as a guy who's consumed a lot of content, I feel when you're watching something like The Northman, the 0.2 ratio difference changes fuck all in your screens.
I think you're right. I think a lot of the time, it's an artistic decision that has very little bearing on the audience.
or the content, I argue.
Well, it depends. I think for something like Oppenheimer, it did make a difference.
I agree with you. I think with Oppenheimer, the image was square, which was squarer, squarish, which means you want to show more top and bottom, right? Same with Dune. I want to see the full scope of Shai Hulud as it comes out of the desert and these Harkonnens piss in their pants. But at the same time, when you've got a film where it isn't merited, right? Like, I don't want to see Oppenheimer or Dune in the 2.31:1 ratio. I don't. But then again, when you're shooting a rom-com, all rom-coms should have the same ratio. Can we just agree, when you're not doing an epic in the desert and or anywhere else, just fucking keep it to one.
You hear that, filmmakers? Bahir has spoken. Calm the fuck down. Pick an aspect ratio and stick with it, goddammit.
Just send out a survey. Get everybody to fill it in, right? Like, there should be conditions. Yes, you want to shoot an IMAX. That's fine. That's cool. You go and play on your own. But everybody else, like anyone but you, doesn't need to be an IMAX ratio.
Cinemas have real trouble with it, right? Because they get a whole bunch of prints. Sometimes certain prints only work on certain screens. Sometimes there are specific instructions that the directors give the exhibitors on how they want their movie to be exhibited, and not every cinema can actually do that. It's a whole thing.
I've got one more. I need to know that people are with me on this, right? My dad has got this bee in his bonnet that anytime he goes to the cinema, which he does a lot, becomes a bee in my bonnet, which is, you've got a black bar, that's fine. Can't you put the subs in the black bar? Everybody, can we just not agree to move the subtitles down into the black bar and not into the already fucking squashed image?
I don't know why they do that.
I don't know why they do that. Why is it not in the black bar? You've got that real estate. Just fucking use it. Also, because I think this, in a way, is a Malaysia-specific problem where our subtitles need to come in threes. Just use the black bars. It's there. It's on your film. It's fine.
It's interesting to note, there isn't any regulation that demands that Malaysia has subtitles or that the subtitles come in threes. But of course, to appeal to as wide an audience as possible, depending on the film, the distributors will decide how many subtitles to put, which is why sometimes you get Malay and Chinese and English. Sometimes you only get Malay and English or Malay and Chinese. And so they kind of base it around who they think the potential audience for a movie might be. But in the worst case scenario, you get three layers of subtitles, plus whatever subtitles are burned into the movie as well, if the people in the movie are shifting languages and switching up their conversations.
And those subtitles have got sometimes, a lot of times, they've got two lines each, which means half the fucking image is covered up by subtitles. Just move it to the black bars, guys.
We've made a case to the distributors that when they do IMAX prints, if they have any power over it at all, to try and not have the subtitles fill up half the frickin' screen.
I want a critical mass here. Can everybody just email podcast@goggler.my and just like, let's get on it. We will forward it along to the relevant distributors. Just like, I can't deal with it anymore.
Yeah, we're done.
We're done. At 0456218888 asks, discuss how The Witcher never lived up to the potential and how it seemed to have gotten boring. Well, 0456218888, I agree with you. It got boring. I don't think I got through season 2. I gave up.
Oh, interesting. I never found it interesting in the first place. I found it constantly boring.
I completely agree with you, but the professional in me was like, oh, let's just finish season 1. Because everybody was so excited for it, right? I never played the games. I didn't read the books. So it's got no hook to me other than the fact that my wife really, really loves Henry Cavill and I was there just to monitor her.
I've played the games. I didn't bother with the books because I went from the game straight to the show and I finished the show to date. I've done all of the episodes.
Wow!
Because I felt that maybe we need to watch them, review them, etc., etc. I've even done the animated spin-off and all of that stuff. And I found it an utter slog. Like, yeah. Cable was good. The Bard was great. But everything else that the showrunners are trying to do with The Witcher just didn't land for me. Season 1, they try to be too smart by playing with time and having these stories run concurrently when they were actually taking place at different times until they all match up at the end of season one. However, what it felt like was one really long pilot episode. Because it dragged on for so long, by the time the climax happened, I was just like, that's it? That's what you were playing at? For me, the reason The Witcher doesn't work is because it feels like everyone making The Witcher knows The Witcher so well that they've put together a version where they forgot to fill us in on all the stuff they know so well. So what we're getting is this weird diluted version where there just isn't enough to keep me excited or interested.
A perfect example of that is when The Witcher sort of pulls out and drinks these magical potions. I don't know what the fuck they do. Like, it means nothing to me. He could have just done a shot of Coke and I don't know anything. And I feel like that was the problem. There was no thought given to the backstory of what The Witcher was until maybe season two, where they tried a little bit.
They tried to do it in the animated show a little bit. And then they tried to do it in that really bad spin-off with Michelle Yeoh, which was god-awful.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
And it was so dull. And they tried to build up all of this backstory. And I don't know what it is. It just felt uninteresting. That said, the latest season of The Witcher, season three, which was Henry Cavill's last season, right, was an utter fiasco. The story plays out, but as you reach the second half of the season, it feels like the showrunners were already hating on Cavill. Like, it's his last season, they don't do a proper goodbye, he's not even in the second last episode at all, because he's been injured and so he's recovering. And so therefore the second last episode doesn't feature him at all. And meanwhile, this is the second last time we'll ever see him as The Witcher. And then in the final episode, it ends on this complete whimper where he spends half the episode recovering and getting back his strength. And then it just kind of ends with him starting off on a journey.
Wow.
Like, there's no fight, there's no climax, there's no proper goodbye. It's like a real fuck you to Henry Cavill, which I think is unfortunate because he does such a great job despite the bad writing he is given in that show.
And I think Henry Cavill is too much of a gentleman to come out and say anything.
Absolutely. I feel really bad for Cavill because he has landed all these dream roles and yet he's given such bad material. Like, even as Superman, I think he looks the part, but he was just given such bad dialogue and such a bad version of Superman that I felt bad for him.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree with you.
We had another question by at 0456-21888, and this one was about StarCraft. I think I wanted to talk about this because I don't think anyone has ever asked us about StarCraft in maybe 15 years.
Sure, let's go.
And so he goes, is StarCraft filmable? I always thought it has the most cinematic story of all the Blizzard games, but the Warcraft movie was such a dud. Halo series probably scared off more investors, but it's doable, no? So first of all, I think the Halo series is actually quite good. I've seen season one. I started season two, I haven't finished it. I think the problem with Halo is that Paramount has the worst marketing team in the history of Hollywood marketing teams, and they don't know how to sell that show. I've never played a single Halo game because I've never owned an Xbox, and yet I find the show compelling. So I think there are a group of sci-fi fans out there who will like the show despite never playing the game. And I think they've ignored that audience completely. And even if you look at the hype around season two when it dropped, practically non-existent.
Yeah.
So that's the problem for me. But going back to StarCraft, I agree with you. I loved the story of StarCraft when I first played those games. I think the Warcraft movie came at a bad time. You're right, it was a bit of a dud. But I just think it's a franchise that no one is looking at right now.
I feel like the problem with Warcraft was the entry point. I think the way they entered into the story was a mistake. I think with StarCraft, I think you can do a very easy, straightforward future of Earth, aliens have come, and oh look, there's a third race kind of movie. Like a war movie, straight up.
It might work better as a TV show, you know?
or a TV show. Yeah. But I think the key is to just make it a Band of Brothers style war epic straight off. Don't try and give me a character to care about. Don't try and tell me their love story and their children's names. I don't give a fuck. Because here's the thing. You're right. StarCraft has a really compelling story. I remember playing StarCraft a lot. I didn't give a shit about the story. I always skipped all the story bits. Like, I just want to start blowing shit up. I want to build bases and go, right? And I feel like if you just do it like that, like a Band of Brothers, Masters of the Air style, I wouldn't call it an anthology series, but just that war-based stuff without being concerned about humanity and being human and telling stories of life and shit like that, I think it'll be great.
I think it'll come around, man. Don't worry about it. Hollywood, at some point, will look through piles of scripts and just be like, oh, wait, here's a franchise we haven't plundered yet. Let's give Blizzard a call. See what's going on.
At Travesty asks, is the music review the hardest to pull off compared to movies, shows, video games, and books?
I don't think so.
I'll be honest, I've never tried. I've never tried reviewing a piece of music.
For me, I don't think so, because I think movies, shows, video games, books, music, I think any kind of review is hard to do.
Oh, okay.
I think all of it involves a certain amount of expertise and study and practice. And I think you need to develop a skill in doing it. And I don't say that it's all the same skill either. Just like with movies, you have to listen to a lot of music. You need to understand music and you need to understand the ins and outs of it before you can actually review it and then translate it into something that someone who doesn't necessarily have as deep an understanding as you can make out what you're trying to say about this album or this song, right? It's the same with video games. It's the same with books. I used to run the literary pages at the NSD and I used to review a lot of books. But the one thing I never did was I never reviewed poetry, because I read some poetry, but I'm in no way an expert. I don't understand poetry the same way that a lot of other people do. And so I left that reviewing to them. But of course, with all kinds of reviewing and criticism, it involves study and practice. So I don't think one is harder than the other. I think it's just a matter of how well versed you are in the subject matter.
The difference for me is that I don't get swept up in the music the way you do. So right. I don't listen to an album as a piece of fiction. I listen to music as a soundtrack to a moment. For me, that's what music is. Like, I can listen to a song that I probably had on repeat when I was studying in the UK, and it will bring me immediately there. But the album, I cannot break down. I cannot analyze the movements from song to song. Because I don't see it as a piece of fiction. I see it as a soundtrack to a moment.
That said, I think the skills required in reviewing anything are the same. It's the same analytical thought process you would employ, whether you are reviewing a movie or a TV show or a video game or a book. Sure, reviewing a video game is different. You're playing it. You're using your motor skills.
You're an active participant in the story.
It's like what you do if you were reviewing a Lego set. Like, what does it mean to actually build it? And so any kind of review, even if you're reviewing makeup, it requires the same set of analytical skills. And so I think that comes with practice. So, yeah. At Adam Weasley asks, how do Malaysian movie producers, distributors, or even normal citizens obtain the data behind movie ticket sales? Do some manipulate numbers to deceive audiences? So that's a very interesting question. Unlike most places in the world, we don't have a report of the weekend box office. Like, come Monday morning, if you look at Deadline, for example, in the US, you will get a breakdown of how every movie that was released in cinemas that week performed.
To be fair, even before a movie opens, you get reports on how a movie is tracking.
Correct. So they've got all of this data. They've got the predictive numbers versus the tracking numbers versus the final numbers. And, you know, as a regular Joe, you can also go to Box Office Mojo and get pretty accurate reporting of that. Malaysian cinemas and distributors don't necessarily release those numbers unless their movie is tracking or doing particularly well. So this week's example, of course, is Sheriff.
Yeah.
Sheriff has made over 22 million in 7 days. Now, that number we take to be pretty accurate because we've spoken to people, They've shared some of their data with us. And what they have is they have a software system where all of the cinemas kind of input their numbers into it, and it's all tracked. Now, we don't have access to that system, but sometimes they're happy to share those numbers with us, especially when a movie is doing as well as Sheriff. You are right in that some people do manipulate those numbers. The Anwar movie is a very good example. We have pretty good information that when they said it made 1 million ringgit, it hadn't actually made 1 million ringgit yet.
Yeah.
I think it eventually hit that number, but it didn't make it in just like 28 or 48 hours.
Yeah.
And that is a common strategy. What they do is they tell people, oh, look, our movie is tracking so well. Aren't you feeling a bit of FOMO for not going to watch this movie? Sometimes what some distributors do is they buy out halls. So they will buy out halls. This usually happens for local movies. The Sonys, the Warners, the Disneys don't bother doing this. But for local movies, we did a little experiment when Anwar the Untold Story was released. We bought a ticket. We went into a supposedly full hall at Mid Valley one weekend and found it to be almost empty. If you clicked on the app, it said that the hall was completely sold out. But when you went in, there were maybe two rows of people sitting in and watching the movie. But what that does is that creates the perception that everyone is flocking to see this movie. And so therefore, you're missing out. So you should buy tickets the next chance you get. It's a marketing strategy more than anything else.
As a firm believer in marketing, maybe they should just spend the money on actual marketing.
I think so too.
Because now the problem is the next movie that is doing well will have this perception on it. I don't know about you, Umar, but even for myself as a professional in this industry, even I have doubts creep in whenever a film comes out and says, oh, we've made $1 million in the first day. And I'm like, are you sure? Did you just buy halls, right?
Of course.
The other thing I want to say is that at the end of every quarter, I know yearly they do it, but I think sometimes they do quarterly as well. Finas will release the numbers. It's a bit of a pain in the ass to find, but it's on their website. They will show the box office takings of all Malaysian films that were released within any given time. Those, I have no doubt, will be official numbers. And when Sheriff says it made 22 million ringgit in the cinema within the first week and a half or whatever it has been, I'd have...
7 days.
7 days, sure. I have no reason to doubt it.
I don't know if I'm naive in thinking this, but I don't think a company like Astro, a public listed company, is going to lie like that. So I have faith that they would get into a lot of trouble if they made up the numbers. So when Astro Shaw says, we made this much money, we are a public listed company, I think it's okay. You can trust those numbers, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the more indie fellas that you got to question.
So that is officially how these numbers are gotten. There's a third party system that all the cinemas and the film distributors, or rather at least the bigger international film distributors, all are a part of. They get these numbers for all the movies that are shown in Malaysia.
And they can track it hour to hour.
And they can track it hour to hour for every ticket sale. Okay, so that's the question. But for me, I'm currently reading a book by a Hollywood journalist who is saying that there is no real value in that, in the reporting of numbers. It is nothing more than just the journalist doing the marketer's job for a studio. For example, I think Variety released this morning the tracking for If's first weekend, the new John Krasinski film, is going to be $40 million. As a journalist, you're not really doing any real work. You might as well have just slapped on a poster in your page and be done with it, because you're doing the marketer's job. You're not questioning whether the movie is good. You're essentially saying that people are excited for this film, so maybe you, the person who isn't, should be excited about it. So there's an argument out there to be made for what essentially we have always been doing, which is not to report those numbers.
Yeah, we don't care about the numbers also because for us, it doesn't necessarily mean a lot.
It means very little. Mat Kilau made a shit ton of money. Meant very little, other than the fact that Malaysians are scary people that I don't want to be caught in an elevator with.
For me, why the numbers are interesting, we'll get to in a couple of questions.
Okay.
Because I think it makes sense when we talk about it within that context. But before we get to that...
At Rabbit Hop asks, do you think Deadpool and Wolverine has the potential to be the Marvel movie that revives the MCU? If not, what will happen to the future of the MCU? When will they stop relying on multiverse characters and cameos to sell a movie instead of a good story? The both of us are kind of anti the argument that the MCU needs to be revived.
You're absolutely right, because I don't think the MCU per se is dead or dying. I think there's a lot of content out there that negates that argument. I think X-Men 97 is a very good example of content coming out from the same company that is very thought out and well produced and quite possibly one of the best things on television right now. Yes, they've had some pretty mediocre films. However, based on the trailer alone, Deadpool and Wolverine looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. And when you say revive, if you mean a movie that will break $1 billion again, then maybe. But I don't think the problem is with multiversal characters or cameos. I think that works as long as the story and the execution is good. I think Spider-Man No Way Home is a very good example of a movie that is entirely built around multiversal characters and cameos, but had a powerful story, some great performances, and just some very good writing. And it worked. We loved it. I think the animated Spider-Verse cartoons are the same thing. They're all cameos and characters, and it's just written well, beautifully animated, great music. It does everything that a good movie should, right? And so it works.
I'm not excusing the writing, the writers, or the filmmakers that have made some of these, let's call them less than stellar films, right? You and I enjoyed The Marvels. You and I enjoyed Ant-Man and Quantumania. However, those were set up at a time where the previous heads of Disney really wanted multiple Marvel movies a year. They wanted multiple billion-dollar titles a year. And that pressure forced Feige to force or slash encourage his writers to write quicker. As much as you may not like a film, as much as you might not like The Marvels, the problem that you see isn't because the writer was bad and or the director was bad, or because it was female-oriented, or because the anti-woke people didn't want to go watch it. It wasn't given the time to breathe and develop and tell a story. And to be fair, look, there is no place for the Marvels within the MCU universe, in the sense that it doesn't sit within the Marvel timeline, right? Like, up to Endgame, you could essentially pinpoint where a movie is sitting and why. Why is Ant-Man where it is in the journey of the Thanos villainy thing? But in this one, it feels like they're rushing it out. They're rushing these movies out because the previous head of Disney wanted these big cash cows, which is why we got quite a few mediocre TV shows. Not bad. We didn't feel like any of them were bad. We enjoyed a lot. Well, except probably
Secret fucking Invasion, which started off great.
Which started off fantastic, by the way. Let's just put it out there. But anyway, the other problem I have with this question, Rabbit Hop, is that Deadpool and Wolverine, whether it has the potential to be the Marvel movie, is doing the Deadpool character a disservice, because the previous two films, before it joined the Disney slash MCU thing, were already fantastic films. To now suddenly saddle it with the weight of being the savior of an MCU feels disingenuous to the character and the filmmakers behind Deadpool.
Apart from the storyline, apart from how the movie performs, you forget that Deadpool comes into cinemas with probably two of the last remaining stars that can carry a film box office-wise. Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman are global names. And so I think they can actually still open a movie, like Tom Cruise, for example, can open a movie, like, well, I was going to say The Rock, but he's had a few bombs recently, so maybe even The Rock can't open a movie in that way anymore.
I will go so far as to say not only Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman, but Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool and Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. So it's not just each actor. It is not just two actors together. It is the two actors together as the two characters that people want to see.
It is also a No Way Home situation. Because you get Hugh Jackman back as Wolverine, it's like getting Tobey Maguire. It's like he'd hung up the claws. He was done. Hugh Jackman was like, I'm old. I'm ready to move on. Oh, wait. one more time. I did that movie called Logan where they killed me off. Oh, no, wait, one more time. And so that in itself seems like it's enough of a pull to get the audiences in.
I love Kevin Feige. I think he's a fantastic producer, story editor, story designer. But he could fuck this up. Everybody involved could fuck this up.
It's possible. But, you know, both Bahe and I have read this book on the MCU, which we recommend that you go out and get. It's just called The MCU. It's this comprehensive history of everything they've done from way before the first Iron Man all the way up to the Marvels. And I think it's a fascinating read. And I think it'll fill you with a newfound respect for someone like Kevin Feige as to just how smart a movie producer he actually is.
There are lines in that book talking about how Feige was able to manage upwards and downwards, right? He was not only able to get good writers and directors, but manage the studio executives above him, you know, pushing back on bad notes and also maybe realizing that some good notes are required.
At My Tipsy Turvy asks, how excited are you for the Rebel Moon Snyder Cut? Seriously though, do you think it'll make any difference? So, I wanted to talk about this in our Rebel Moon review, but I forgot to bring it up. Which is, some of the responses we get to our review of both these movies have been, oh no, wait until you see the director's cut, it's going to be a lot better. I think people are failing to understand the function and purpose of a director's cut. There are a lot of director's cuts out there. Apocalypse Now has one, Blade Runner has multiple. And a lot of the time, the director's cut exists because of studio interference. Sometimes when you're a new director, like Ridley Scott at the time, studio comes along, watches Blade Runner and goes, we don't understand this. Audiences are not going to understand this. Oh, look, that focus group didn't get it. Let's add a really terrible voiceover to it. And maybe that might make people love this movie. And so studio interference, investor interference, sometimes directors don't get final cut of their movie. Actually, most of the time, directors don't get final cut of their movies. And then the product that comes out is not their vision. And then when they make it big and famous, they go, hey, I want to revisit this movie that I felt was a masterpiece and that was hard done by the studio at the time, and here is my final cut. To a certain extent, that applies to Zack Snyder's Justice League. The studio took it away from him. They were freaked out after the failure of BVS, and they went, you know what? There's a lot of fan requests for this, when there actually weren't. They were mostly bots on Twitter. But there are lots of fan requests for this. So go ahead, here's some money, finish up your movie the way you wanted to.
As much as I hated all versions of that film, I feel like Zack Snyder turning a 2-hour dour movie into an 8-hour dour TV series is okay.
I think it was still the best version of that fiasco.
But that's what a director's cut should be, right? If you're going to do a version, it better be a version that is significantly different than the original. You can't just add 3 scenes and call it a director's cut.
Now, I don't know what the Rebel Moon director's cut is going to be. It might be significantly different. However, what is it? Why is it?
Yeah.
He has a deal with Netflix. He has complete creative control from what we understand, because if he didn't, we wouldn't get this kind of garbage. And yet, there was a need to make 2 versions of this film. It's Netflix. You have parental controls. You don't have to release a 13 version of something. First, you're not selling tickets. You're not alienating audiences. Just release your R-rated cut in the first place. Who cares? Why have a director's cut? For me, it feels like a shameless marketing exercise more than anything else. And it feels like he's cashing in on this idea that the Snyder cut is a big deal. And I think that's just appalling. I don't think it's going to make a difference, because more sex, more violence, more backstory by way of exposition is not going to make these movies any better.
I feel like it is a watering down of the cash that you already have. He essentially has to recut 2 films now, right? Which means there are costs involved. Why don't you just put that money into the production in the first place? I feel like it does nothing. Like, I will be shocked if it changes anything.
I would be shocked if it changes my opinion on the film.
I will be shocked if it moves the needle in a positive way. I might watch it and realize that this version is way worse because it's now just longer with more sex and violence and more exposition, but it's still essentially the same bloody story, which just annoys me even more.
So yeah, at my tipsy-turvy, I don't think it's going to make a difference.
I mean, it might make a difference, but just not in a positive way.
Oh, possibly. Yes, potentially. It might be shitter.
At Thush6303 asks, there is an increasing disparity between the critic scores and audience scores in recent times. Case in point, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire and even Godzilla Kong. Why do you think this disparity exists? Are critics overanalyzing or are audiences just looking for mind-numbing entertainment and escapism in theaters? Or is there a deeper issue here?
This is why I wanted to talk about the numbers again, but I'll get to that. Tush6303 is not wrong. There have been a bunch of reports of late post-pandemic that actually have shown this to be a fact. Over the years, you've always had critic scores versus audience scores, and sometimes the disparity may be within a few points. Mm. But if you look at something like 2022, for example, it was the first big year post-pandemic, right? Movies like Top Gun Maverick, Jurassic World were in the box office, Doctor Strange made lots of money, but the critic scores versus audience scores were wider than ever before. Like Jurassic World Dominion, terrible critical reviews, audiences seem to like it. Same with Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Thor Love and Thunder. I think Sonic the Hedgehog 2 as well. Critics were middling on it, but audiences like well over 80%. The Gray Man, which we felt was a terrible fucking movie, audiences seemed to like it for some reason. But I think there exists that disparity for a couple of reasons. Now, that disparity primarily tends to exist only with blockbusters. It almost never exists with something that is either an indie production or an awards contender. Occasionally, that might be the case, but more often than not, it's not like a 30-point divide. With the blockbusters, sometimes audiences are looking for mindless escapism, which isn't to say that critics aren't. I think the best critics know how to weigh a movie for what it's setting out to do. I think Siskel and Ebert, for example, were a fantastic group of critics who always understood or judged a movie based on what its own ambitions were and whether it actually achieves that ambition. We try to do the same, both Bahir and I. We don't judge a movie based on what we want it to be or what we were hoping it would be or even some misplaced sense of art. We always try and critique a movie based on whether it achieved what it set out to do. So the escapism is a true thing, and I think that's been apparent. As for the divide, though, I think there is something deeper at play. And I think a lot of that has to do with amateur reviewers and critics, for example, on TikTok, on Instagram, the everyday reviewer, for example, who claims to speak for the common man. I think that's a very interesting approach to judging films because you don't necessarily get an expert opinion, but you get an opinion. And so because the playing field is so wide now and there are so many opinions, you can lean in any way you want, in whichever direction you want. And I think that often affects the way the discourse plays out. So you can go hyper-conservative, you can go anti-woke, you can go pro-feminist in any movie, right? And so all of these opinions and subcategories and everything that ranges from the political to the social, everything comes into play in every discussion. And so because of that, I think that actually affects the way that we perceive and consume movies. I know we say, oh, look, it's just a movie, but no, it's not. It is part of our cultural discourse. I mean, what was that Jim Caviezel movie that made a shit ton of money because all the conservatives went to watch it? The one about children's kidnapping?
Oh, the kidnapping one.
I haven't seen it. I know it's on Prime Video or something. I just haven't brought myself to watch it because the people behind it are a little crazy. From what I understand, the people behind it kind of believe that Hillary Clinton eats babies.
It's the Pizzagate guys.
It's the Pizzagate guys.
I don't want to say it's the problem. I feel like what's important here is just like AI, just like deepfake, you have to know it's out there. So you have to find the reviewers that you agree with, that you like, that you are on the same wavelength with. and ignore the others. Because there will be people out there who will tell you that Pooh, Blood and Honey is the best horror movie out there. And you and I will question their sanity. So the question here is, do you agree with his review of everything else? So if you don't, then he's not someone you should listen to. It also comes down to the Rotten Tomatoes version of what critically acclaimed may be.
Which is bullshit.
Which is bullshit, right? Rotten Tomatoes doesn't have an opinion. Rotten Tomatoes aggregates and mathematically calculates a variation of opinions, which, you know, are based on sometimes up to 12 people. And that can't be critically acclaimed.
But what you said earlier, Bahe, has always been true as to how criticism kind of works in its relationship to the audience. I mean, I used to do that and I still do that. There are some critics that I follow who enjoy the same sorts of movies I do. And so when I read those reviews for recommendations, for example, I know what I'm going to get. And a lot of the time, as a consumer, you want to watch the stuff that you know you're going to like or that's going to make you think. And so you gravitate towards certain critics or reviewers that speak on the same wavelength as you. And it's always been the case. If you are conservative leaning, for example, it's not like you're going to watch someone who is hyper-liberal review something because it's just going to make you angry. For the work we do, we read everything because we want to know what the other voices are saying. Even if we completely disagree with it, we'd like to know what their arguments are and why they believe a certain thing. And so you can do the same thing as well, just so that you know it's out there and you know what you're getting. A lot of the time, however, in this new world where media is diversified, where everyone on TikTok has a voice and everyone on social media has a voice, it's also important to know where you're getting your information from. You have to be conscious that a lot of the stuff on TikTok is also paid for. It may not necessarily claim to be paid for, but TikTok runs a business in which distributors and cinemas pay them a certain fee to get influencers to actually talk about their movies in a positive light. It's not often marked as sponsored content, but it exists. And so having that consciousness and awareness will allow you and give you a more informed approach whenever you actually consume this sort of reviews or information. As for the money thing, I think it's important to bring it up because the conversation then goes back to, oh, well, Godzilla and Kong has made hundreds of millions at the box office, so therefore all of the critics are wrong. But it's not about right and wrong. And I think that's what people need to understand. When it comes to critiquing movies or books or music or whatever, it's about dissecting a work of art and giving an opinion on why it works or why it doesn't. It may work for some people, it may not work for others. And I think that's where the interesting exercise exists.
I want to say two things. Like what you like. I think if you are a guy who likes big monsters fighting, and you hear me, a guy who wants stories behind the big monsters fighting, and I didn't like Godzilla X Kong, then that's fine. We don't have to be enemies. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like, I loved Frozen Empire. Others didn't. And that's fine. There's a fundamental confusion sometimes with regards to reviews. I don't think that a review should be the be-all and end-all of a film.
Of course not.
The point of a review is to tell you what that person thought of the thing. Whether you agree or not with that person, the point is that you should probably go and find out for yourself.
The point of a review is to spark conversation and discourse.
And that conversation can be you going and watching a movie.
Absolutely.
I also want to just bring out, there is also that other deeper issue that we kind of don't want to talk about because it's stupid and we don't want to give it oxygen, which is the review bombers. Those guys suck. Fuck off to those guys. The guys who will review bomb a film before it even opens, they're dicks. Don't listen to them. They're idiots. That's fine.
Final question is from Lego Fan in PJ. List off the top of your minds movies that never should have existed in the first place but were enabled by blind Hollywood executive that spawned a crappy franchise or body of work by awful and mediocre filmmakers and which are not named Rebel Moon or Blood and Honey. I might have chosen Alvin and the Chipmunks on behalf of those poor kids who actually saw it in cinemas. Instead, I've picked out a so-called parody film I watched on bootleg once, Spy Hard, written by those two snake oil salesmen, Friedberg and Seltzer, who went on to form their awful body of work for the next two decades. Scary movie, disaster movie, epic movie, etc.
Wow. Lego fan and PJ, you've thought about this.
You have thought about this. I'm very impressed. We applaud you. So when discussing something like this, I know it's easy to go with movies that we don't necessarily like. So for example, you might say Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, which was an awful movie. A lot of people go, it ruined that perfect trilogy. It should never have been made. The Matrix Resurrections comes to mind. But then again, those last two Matrix movies weren't great either. So
yeah.
Why the fuck not, right?
Yeah.
But for me, the movies that always come to mind whenever people ask me this are those Disney direct-to-video spin-offs. I actually just dislike them with a passion. Lion King 1.5, Little Mermaid 2, Aladdin, whatever. Very few of those, and I mean very, very, very few, like a minuscule amount, actually had stories that are memorable, animation that was good, songs that actually you gave a shit about. For the most part, they felt like shameless cash grabs. They were subcontracted out to Disney in Australia, I think, that produced most of those. And they were just awful. It was just the Disney company going, oh, well, parents saw that. They know the kids loved it. Here, let's shove more VHSs at them and DVDs at them and make them buy this shit. Those are the movies that should have never been made.
For me, I would go a little newer. I feel like this will get me the ire of many a parent. But I am so fucking done with the Despicable Me series.
Hear, hear.
Because for me, you know what it is?
Like, that first movie was really good. I really enjoyed it.
For me, my issue isn't just the follow-ups. My issue is that the follow-ups have no intrinsic value. They don't have a different version of the story. It's the same story with a different colored villain and possibly a different type of problem, in air quotes, that they have to solve.
It's the problem with all Illumination movies.
It's the problem with all Illumination movies.
It's the universal cash grab. It's Minions, Despicable Me, those fucking troll movies. Shameless. Absolutely shameless.
For me, that's a problem because, for example, the Train Your Dragon series, those were very good. There was an evolution of the characters. There was an evolution of the story of said characters, right? Because the idea is that the kid that loved it when they were one age will have grown older the next time. So Toothless is older. The boy that is the squire and or rider of Toothless is older. So there's an evolution of the characters because they know the people who are watching it have also gotten older. However, all Despicable Me's and Minions feel like they're for the same exact age group. Build a new thing for that age group, right? Why is that baby still a fucking baby in this upcoming Despicable Me? Maybe she needs to be taken to a doctor because she's got growth issues. That's gotten my goat at the moment. And whether or not these films should exist, spawning crappy franchises, I don't know. I think the first Despicable Me should have existed, should exist. I think the second one was fine, but the doubling down on the Minions as a marketing thing for a studio as opposed to film is the problem.
I will say this though, to answer your question, there are a lot of bad movies out there that I think should exist. Truly, truly terrible, awful movies that I think should exist. I think, one, either they're interesting experiments, or two, they exist to show future filmmakers what not to do, or three, just as artists finding their footing. I think there are a lot of times even great directors have produced terrible work, not even as early works, but in between their careers. And I think that actually symbolizes a lot and tells you so much about the artist and the work of art. That said, there is no reason for disaster movie and epic movie and any of those movies to exist because I think those guys truly are snake oil salesmen. Just awful.
We've gone on a rant, but...
But yeah, you know.
Lego fan in PJ, I don't know if we answered your question, but that's the answer to your question.
And those are the answers to all of your questions this week. Keep them coming in. DM us on our social media feeds, GogglerMY. You can also email us on podcast@goggler.my or send us a WhatsApp on the Goggler hotline, 012-524-5208. This has been another episode of Ask Us Anything. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Goggler Podcast.
Also, don't forget to email us about that subtitle thing, podcast@goggler.my.